A podcast of the cinema.
Brought to you by you. Hang on, I'm just pushing this. It won't go off. You the listeners with your Patreon subscriptions. We'll tell you all about that later like we always do.
Mm-hmm. As well as some exciting holiday season retail opportunities.
My name is Dave White. Cuck boss.
Don't even start with that garbage.
I just pulled that out of nowhere a few weeks ago, and I've had like three people come to me on Facebook and Twitter and say that's the best thing you ever. That's the best nickname that you've ever come up with for yourself.
That is not sticking. That's just I'm not giving those people a moment of my thoughts. I'm Alonzo Duraldi.
We're both film critics.
Yes.
He's a more important film critic than I am, but whatever. In this room, all men are equal.
As you wish.
If this is your first time listening, we're a film podcast. Also, we are married to each other. That's why you may occasionally hear him slip up and call me sweet names. Like... baby.
Please, no references to nasty, though, because that is already played out.
What was...
My name ain't baby, you know.
My first name ain't baby. Yeah. It's Janet, etc.
Yes.
Okay. No. The nasty thing went very viral very quickly.
Very quickly.
Within seconds.
Yeah.
Actually. And which is kind of why I... In spite of it all, I love the internet.
This is true. They will call you out.
And now I'm ready to...
The downside is they will call you out.
I guess that's a downside. I don't know. It's only a downside if you need to get called out, right?
I know, but it just, you know, it's a tricky sword. You never know when it's going to come back at you.
Not if you're being nice. Why don't you just keep being nice?
You're right.
Keep being nice. Don't you and I both have that reputation as the nice film critic?
We're so nice.
We're so nice.
We're so nice.
Except you insulted Kate Beckinsale just today.
I did not.
And Whit Stillman came at you.
I did.
Because you weren't nice.
I was not being insulting. Here's the thing. I went to go see Boo a Madea Halloween this
morning. You did. Yes.
I was supposed to see it Thursday night. I bought a ticket, posted a picture of my ticket on Instagram and everything. Yes. Turns out our AMC accidentally put... that it was starting at 10:20 in their system. 10:20 p.m., which is late for me, but I was just getting out of Doctor Strange. I was like, okay, sure, why not?
Yeah.
But oops, they meant 10:50, which I discovered only when I entered the theater at 10:10 and the movie was still running from the previous show. And you know how it is at AMC. No one knows anything. They send you to guest services. No. Guest services is closed. But finally, somebody with a walkie figures out what's going on and oops. And so I got my money back. I got a free soda, small soda and popcorn coupon.
Really?
Yes. Which I've not used yet. And then I went back this morning.
Save those for a special day.
That's right. So I went back this morning to see.
I'll take them with me when I go to see I Am Not Ashamed.
Oh, you could do that. Yeah.
Yeah.
Oh, that's right. We were gonna. You didn't get to that this week.
Okay. I will. I'm going to go out this week to the mall. It's at the Burbank Mall.
Of course,
our favorite Burbank Mall. And I'm going to go see it.
Anyway, so I'm watching the trailers before Boo a Madea Halloween.
Yeah.
And they're a mixed bag. And I had been trying not to watch the Fences trailer, which I kept hearing about, but there it was, and that looks like it.
They didn't have that at the Grove.
But anyways, then they play the Underworld Blood Wars trailer.
Right.
And I see that it's coming out in early 2017. And so jokingly, I tweeted, if Kate Beckinsale gets an Oscar nomination for Love and Friendship, Will Underwood Blood War, Underworld Blood Wars be her Norbit?
The answer is yes.
And Whit Stillman,
he didn't like that,
tweeted, "Oh, come on."
That's right. He didn't like that.
And he spelled on A-W-N. So I was like, on.
Yeah. He has every reason to defend his lady.
And I tweeted back at him. I said, let me be very clear. I love her work in LNF.
You and Whit Stillman are going to go at it all day now. It's going to be a punching.
I got no
it's
beef.
It's going to be a slap fight.
I got no
pretty
beef.
Soon.
I got no beef with Whit Stillman. Did a lovely Q&A with him earlier this year, in fact.
Slap fight.
No.
Shall we begin with Boo A Medea Halloween?
Why not? Because it is a packed week, so we can't have our usual blather and palaver and.
Wait. It was chit chat and clap trap.
Chit chat and clap trap. Yeah. Thank you.
There's not to beat the dead horse. we found ourselves with a 2-star review on iTunes recently.
Which we'll accept that, you know, whatever.
It's fine. It's funny
it's
to
not
me.
Not your cup of tea.
We were accused of not getting to the movies fast enough, which is a fact. We don't get to them fast enough. We have chit chat and we have claptrap.
It's true. We built a show on it.
That's pretty much, yeah. But we don't have time for that this week. We don't have time to loll around and just be...
talking about donuts talking or something.
Exactly. Boo, A Medea Halloween.
Yes.
I'm getting nothing in my headphones from this microphone.
I just turned you down a bit because...
I need to turn up my
You need volume? To turn up... Why don't you do that? Okay. Yes. Because what's in your ears is the least important thing right now.
I see. But here's my question. When you turn me down on the board, does that mean I'm less loud? That's going to affect how loud I am in my headphones, right?
Yes, because I turned your mic down because I realized not that anyone cares about this. We switched boards out because we were too soft on the TV podcast this week and we were being too loud on this one and I didn't want you frying everybody's speakers. So I turned you down a bit.
That's pretty exciting.
Isn't it?
Okay, so I saw Boo, A Medea Halloween on Thursday night while you were seeing Doctor Strange. Uh-huh. The Tyler Perry Films...
never, ever, ever.
There have been a grand total of 1 Tyler Perry movies that got a press screening. That was for Colored Girl.
Yes.
Because he was convinced...
That was his Oscar time.
That was his Oscar time.
Did they screen Diary of a Mad Black Woman?
No.
Okay, so even from the get-go, it was like, no.
I saw that at the Beverly Center.
Oh.
Remember back in the day?
Mm-hmm.
Beverly Center was the Burbank 8?
Yes.
Yeah.
Where movies go to die.
And they shut it down fully, entirely. Burbank 8's not going to be Burbank 8 for much longer. They're renovating.
Really?
Yeah.
Are they going to stay within the same space they're in? Are they going to knock out like Dairy Queen or something?
It would appear that they're staying in the same space, but they're putting in those reclining seats.
Ooh.
Yeah.
Okay.
It saddens me a little bit.
There is something to be said about the junk theater, but I like those reclining seats.
They're nice.
Okay, so you went...
I didn't get a Fences trailer.
All right.
So I still haven't seen the trailer for Fences.
Okay. I got Fences, I got Hidden Figures, I got
Almost Christmas.
I got Almost Christmas.
I got Hidden Figures.
And I got Underworld Blood Wars.
I didn't get that.
And The Bye-Bye Man.
What's that?
It's like Candyman, basically, but like if you even think his name, you give him strength or something. It's got the kid who was the son, the oldest son on Big Love in it.
Hmm. Anyway. Someone on Twitter this week said that, to this day, even though they know it's just a movie, they will not say Candyman, 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 Candyman.
Oh, is it 5? I thought it was just 3.
5 times.
Okay, I'm thinking of Beetlejuice.
Yeah. Well, maybe it's 3. I thought it was 5.
I don't know.
In any case, Candyman is so good. Boo, A Medea Halloween, is as good as you want it to be.
Yeah, it does sort of reward expectations.
It is about Medea And she has her nephew, Brian, played by
Tyler Perry.
And he has a teenage daughter that I guess we've never seen before.
And
an ex-wife that I never knew about.
It's hard to keep track of the extended Madea family tree from movie to movie. Is, I don't know that it's always consistent.
I don't think Tyler Perry has a Madea,
a chart.
A Madea universe Bible.
Mm-hmm.
I don't think that he cares too much for the Madea family continuity. Yeah,
I think they're there when they're necessary.
There are some consistencies. Joe is Medea's brother.
Yes, and Brian is Joe's son. Is Bam a relative, or is he just Aunt Bam as a nickname?
I think Bam is just a friend.
Okay.
Cora
is Medea's daughter.
Is Medea's daughter. Mr. Brown is not Cora's father because they went on Maury Povich at the end of Big Happy Family.
Yes.
Or I can do battle by myself.
No, Big Happy Family.
They went on Maury Povich at the end of Big Happy Family. I just watched all of these again recently to do a very important ranking list for the rap.
Go check out Dave's listicle on the Madea movies.
So Mr. Brown was supposed to be Cora's father, but now we know that he's not, and Madea has no idea who Cora's father was. It was speculated in that film that her father might be Tom Joyner or Bill Clinton.
Oh, that's right.
But then there are all these people that you either see or never see, like Kimberly Elise. Is Madea's granddaughter, but you haven't seen her since Diary of a Mad Black Woman.
Yeah, because Madea has had a family reunion and a Big Happy Family movie, and there's no overlap.
Well, there's some overlap. There's always Cora.
A few, yeah, but like is Cicely Tyson in there somewhere?
Cicely Tyson is often around.
But is she related?
She was in, somehow. Cicely Tyson was in Diary of a Mad Black Woman.
And Family Reunion.
But Maya Angelou was in Family Reunion.
Right, but I don't think they were passing her off as a relative person.
I don't know if they were or not. So
confusing.
Anyway, Brian has a rebellious teenage daughter.
Yes.
Who is determined at age 17 that she's going to go to a fraternity party.
Right.
A fraternity Halloween party. And honestly, he could allow her to go to this fraternity Halloween party because they are the dumbest, most Disney-fied fraternity that you've ever seen in your life.
Yeah. Yeah. That's true.
And
but they're still rapey.
Quite. Yeah. You're right. They are.
I mean, thankfully, the fact that the girls are 17 puts the brakes on.
For them, yeah.
But that seems to be the only thing, you know.
But so
by the way, on your list, you said that Madea twerks to a Tyga song.
She does.
Actually, no, Hattie twerks to Tyga.
And then Madea dances to it. She twerks, too.
Does she?
Yeah, she gets down and she does. The camera's not on her.
Oh, you see. Oh, that's true. Okay, you're right.
But
all right.
Hattie twerks, and then Madea's like, I'll do that, too. And she starts dancing.
You're right. You're right.
Yeah. Where did Hattie come from?
I don't know.
Hattie's new.
Yeah, I was wondering.
Hattie is a new character that I've never seen before. Madea talks in such a way that there are moments where you can't understand what she's saying. Hattie is incomprehensible all the time.
Even to Madea.
Yeah.
Well, so, I can understand Madea perfectly.
So
I'm from the South.
You're from the Georgia South. Yes. So yeah. Okay, so the kid makes up a story to scare Madea and the old people, Bam and Hattie and Joe, to scare them away from coming to babysit her at the house because Brian wants her babysat while he has to go off to work on Halloween night. It doesn't make sense.
Yeah.
And in order to get the old people away from her so she can sneak out of the house to go to the Halloween
party. She makes up this whole story about how there'd been a mass murder in the house and it was haunted every Halloween. Yeah.
But then, why no one else ever brought this story up, it doesn't matter. Yeah. We don't care We just know that there are going to be pranks played to make Medea and her friends think there are ghosts and killer clowns and
zombies
and everything chasing them. All of this is great because what it means is that Medea will punch them all in the face.
Yes.
And knock them out.
Smack
them
with her purse.
Yeah. And that's pretty much what happens.
Yeah.
There's a lot of chasing. There is a moment in this movie where Medea falls down a flight of stairs. And I have never laughed so hard. First of all, in 2016, I have not laughed this hard in all of 2016. And I have not laughed this hard at any Medea movie, at any one particular scene, as this one. It is the best falling downstairs slapstick scene I have seen in maybe forever. Sean Abley and his husband, Matt, they were with me.
Mm-hmm.
Matt could hardly wait to get out of the theater. Uh-huh. Like, this was his first Medea film.
Mm-hmm.
He had no idea what he was getting himself into, and he was not into it. When she fell down the stairs, Sean and I
fell out.
Floor. Yeah, like, as did the entire audience. It may be the greatest Medea moment that has ever been.
It's up there with some of the stuff from Family Reunion or Big Happy Family.
That and driving the car into the fast food restaurant in Family Reunion.
Big Happy Family.
In Big Happy Family. Forgive me. Yeah. Family Reunion is not that great at all.
Big Happy There's Family.
Not
however.
Much Medea in it.
Yeah,
even
that's
though she's
problem.
In the title.
That's what I like about Boo. There are things that bug me
it's
about
all Medea.
The thing that bugs me about Medea movies is that A, when Medea goes off screen, it becomes a snooze.
Yeah.
And B, at some point, the ham-fisted Tyler Perry churchy moralizing comes in.
Yes.
And there's none of that in this movie.
There's
a sprinkling of
there's
it.
Always
but
a little bit.
For the most part, the church people are kind of getting goofed on.
The church people are always getting goofed on until it's time for them not to get goofed on.
Right, but even then in this movie, it's a gentle touch.
She does get born again.
Yes,
at one
only because she's running from zombies. It's a much gentler touch from Tyler Perry, and ultimately, it's not even just that it's the church coming in to be the church. It's more like the adults coming in to be the adults. Yes. Like everybody, knock it off with the pranks, and let's all calm down.
Yeah. Yeah.
So that I think it works really well, and as a story, and as it's presented, it is competent. He's still a fairly hacky director, but he's not like as terrible as he used to be.
Here's the thing about his filmmaking: he loves to improvise. And it shows.
Yeah.
And they even tell you over the closing credits, over the closing credits of any Tyler Perry movie are the bloopers and the outtakes.
Yeah.
And at one point, the woman who's playing Bam, and I don't know the actress's name, but she's always Bam.
Yeah.
They leave this in as a blooper. Like, this is a blooper that Tyler Perry wants you to hear. She says, maybe we could go back to the script. So, and then she says, because we've said things twice. And the thing about the saying things twice is that he's such a crappy editor or hires such incompetent editors that those things sometimes stay in the film.
Well, in the early ones, yes.
No, in this one. In all of them.
Well, because, no, because
these are not good movies.
No, they aren't.
They're great movies.
But he does.
But they're not good.
But he does actually hire a competent editor. He I don't know if it's on this one, but for a lot of his recent films, he's had Maisie Hoy, who worked on Altman stuff.
Good Deeds is the most competently filmed movie that he's ever made.
Yes. Also, super dull.
Also super boring, and it made 10 cents.
Yes.
Yeah.
But it looks like a movie.
Right.
I mean, yeah. But there was a period there, you know, we talked about this when Witness Protection came out, where it was like you could tell he was done with Medea. He didn't want to do it anymore.
He was tired.
He was like...
He was tired of her.
It was like this forced death march of Medea movie.
Yeah.
And then somehow, I don't know if it's...
Christmas.
No, what I was going to say is I don't know if it's that For Color Girls didn't do well, or that he is like the king of television now with all of his stuff on TBS and OWN and whatever.
Yeah.
He's found a second wind with her.
He has turned a corner in his relationship with her.
Yeah.
Because that is absolutely correct. During witness protection, you could tell he was tired and the character was tired and he was tired of being her.
Yeah.
And then came this invigoration, you know, a resurgence. The Christmas movie, she was back on track, you know. This movie, same.
Yeah.
But once again, these are not good films.
No.
But they are
entertaining.
They are completely funny and entertaining and just stupid. And I have an inexplicable good time. And this is different than the good time I have while watching his extremely bad dramas,
yes,
such as Temptation,
right,
or Why Did I Get Married 2.
These are intention. The Madea movies are intentionally funny,
and they generally are.
Yeah.
And then there's the weirdness. There's always the weirdness. Because Tyler Perry, as a human being, is a man obviously at war with himself.
Mm-hmm.
And that is why he is always three different characters.
Yes.
In these films. There's Madea, who is actually Antichrist. And I don't mean that she is the Antichrist. I mean,
she's pure id.
She is Antichrist. She cannot wait to mock Christians.
Yeah.
The best line and the best line delivery that she ever did on this subject was, she was riding in a car with Cora in one of the films, and Cora gets cut off, and Cora can't bring herself to do anything about it because she's wearing her What Would Jesus Do bracelet. And Madea looks at Cora with a big, wide-eyed, mocking expression and says, "Did you show him your bracelet, Cora?"
Could we make the case that Madea, Joe, and Brian are id, ego, and superego?
Yes. Yes. Because then you've got Joe, who is obscene.
Yes.
He's obscene in a way
he's
that...
He's a dirty old man.
He's a dirty old man. In a way that Madea is not really dirty. Like,
she has a past.
She has a past, but her present is matriarch.
Yeah.
Joe is a dirty old man.
He's still Randy.
Joe will fart. Joe smokes weed. Madea does not smoke weed.
Anymore.
Joe smokes weed.
And Joe still wants to get it.
And Joe still wants to have sex all the time with whoever.
Yeah.
And then there's Brian, played by actual Tyler Perry.
Without the fat suit and the latex makeup.
I think that Brian, as a character, as a bland, boring character, is Tyler Perry's ideal man.
He is a straight man in every way possible.
Yeah. And this is where you hear Tyler Perry being Tyler Perry. Because there's a very, let's just say it, there's a disturbing sequence in Boo where Brian talks about the physical abuse
he suffered.
He suffered as a child at the hands of Madea and Joe.
Yes.
So much so that he wound up in the hospital.
Right.
And their defense is, well, that's what you do to kids to make them behave. And,
yeah. Did you die?
And train them up the way they should go.
Yeah.
That is a very old school Southern
spare the rod,
spoil the child attitude, obviously taken to comic extreme effect in a film that thinks child abuse can be funny. Brian actually says, no, this was child abuse and you did terrible things to me.
Yeah. And
this film kind of stops for a beat for you to absorb that.
And the thing that he doesn't want to say to them, that he half says to them, is, I don't want my kids to turn out like you.
Yeah. Here's the weird thing about this. It's not weird. It's factual. Tyler Perry was abused brutally as a child.
Yes.
By his father, I think.
I believe, yeah.
And, oops, there goes some equipment that I clunked. Did I just ruin anything?
No, it's fine.
No, okay. And,
stop clunking.
So, it's strange to hear him sort of process this on camera and not on Oprah, which is where he used to do it.
Right.
When she still had a show, he would talk about it on her show.
The movie does at least, I think, come around in a way to have the happy, because Brian's method of parenting is so
ineffectual.
Ineffectual and wimpy. Yeah. And obviously Joe and Medea's is so like violent and abusive. The movie does figure out a way to split the difference and like be tough on kids without laying a hand on them.
Right.
Which I frankly, if any movie had me worried that, oh God, they're going to come out and advocate spanking, it would be a Tyler Perry movie. Because these are really reactionary films in a lot of ways.
Oh yeah.
So, yeah.
Also, she's totally trending with the creepy clown
thing. Yeah, the clown thing. They are on point with the clown.
They must have shot that 3 weeks ago.
I think they just got lucky. Because clowns are always creepy, but they just, it happens that they're in the zeitgeist.
I think they shot it 3 weeks ago.
It's also distinctly possible. But there's two different clown segments, though.
So. True. I love...
What? There's a whole opening sequence about how Bam gives out candy on Halloween and just because she steals. She puts one lollipop in the kid's bucket and then like brings her hand out with like four pieces of their other candy.
Yeah, that's good. That's a good trick.
I'm sorry. I like the Madea movies.
It's like watching like watching a Charlie Brown Christmas. No, sorry. It's like watching It's the Great Pumpkin, Charlie Brown.
Uh-huh.
You and I were doing, what was it, last night?
Yeah.
And you telling me the story that at the Charles Schultz home.
Oh, yeah. His daughter.
There would be years where, just as sort of a joke, they would give out rocks, which to me is brilliant. And imagine if you were a kid in Northern California and you were trick or treating at Charles Schultz's house and you got a rock.
Yeah.
You would save that rock. You would get it rest. You would have it bronzed. Yeah. You would be like, Charles Schultz gave me a rock
on Halloween
in my back. Like, maybe in the moment you would think, what's going on? And your parents would have to maybe explain it to you, remember on the cartoon, blah, blah, blah. Enjoy the rest of your candy. A famous person just did a thing for you.
Yeah.
That was cool.
You put this movie, like, what, fourth, fifth on the Madea list?
I think it is not as funny as Madea Christmas.
Oh, see, I think it's funnier than Madea Christmas.
Do you think so?
Well, let me put it this way. I think there's more Madea in here. Madea Christmas has more...
There is more Madea in this film, but when Madea is in a Madea Christmas, she's fighting the KKK.
Well, yes.
And... she's crucifying children with Christmas lights.
Yes,
and
also true.
Larry the Cable Guy
also true
shows up.
But I think,
and he is man Madea.
He is. He is white guy Madea for sure. But here's the thing, though.
Yes.
So many of these movies fall apart because the plotting is so terrible, and the really terrible in Madea Christmas. Evil corporation sweeps in, but we're just going to go. We'll say on television that they promised to do something, and now they are honor bound to do it because we said it on television. Like that's how they resolve the plot.
Right.
This movie. Because its plot stuff is so focused on like Madea and her people,
the haunted
house, and the frat people,
right.
Like it mostly makes sense. Like there's a few things in the ending where you could be like, wait, what? How did they swing? But you know,
listen,
I'm just
my list is not definitive.
I understand that, but I'm saying I would put this second. I think I would put this right behind Big Happy, Big Happy Family.
No,
on my list of favorite Madea
goes
movies.
To jail is gold.
Yeah. See, that one has super preachy.
Yeah, it's totally super preachy.
Yeah.
But then she dances out of prison in that house dress.
I know, but like that was the movie where...
She makes friends with
Sofia Vergara.
Serial killer Sofia Vergara.
But I'll tell you, like that was the movie where I felt like, oh, Madea's becoming too much of a thing. Like when Dr. Phil now wants to be in a Madea movie.
Right.
I don't know. It turned me off a little. I put this one second behind Big Happy Family.
You said Candyman five times, by the way.
Okay, fine.
I just Googled it. So.
Good to know. Yeah. All right. Now let's see the three other big wide releases this weekend. Madea is probably going to win the weekend. By the way,
good.
Of the three other big wide releases, you saw none of them. So I'll zip through them.
What did I not see?
I'll zip through them fairly quickly.
I'm going to see Jack Reacher, but I missed the screen.
Okay, Jack Reacher, Never Go Back. Tom Cruise is back as Jack Reacher. It is fine. You know, it is a competently put together action movie. Nothing special, but it is entertaining enough, and I was never bored or mad at it, but it's nothing special. As Matt Atchity said on What the Flick, it does what it says on the box.
Here's why I haven't seen the big major releases of the week. I'm in the middle of a very large project. You will never know what that project is because it's sort of a non-disclosure agreement situation. But it involves a lot of work on my part that I just cannot discuss. Therefore, I saw some art house things this week.
No, it's fine.
But I haven't seen the big wide it's release fine. Movies.
If you don't see Jack Reacher until Cable, fine.
Really?
Really, yes.
Do you think they're going to send us a Christmas copy?
I doubt it. I don't think that's a real awardsy movie. I'm going to say, of the other wide releases of the weekend, if you're going to see one, you should see Ouija Origin of Evil. Because I know you hated the first Ouija movie.
Convince me.
Everybody but me hated the first Ouija
convince
movie.
Convince me.
Well, they hired the guy who did Oculus.
All right, that was not bad.
And this one is, I think, genuinely creepier and more stylish, and it's got some good performances in it. It's set in 1967, Los Angeles. It's a prequel to the first movie to sort of find out how we got to where we got. And Elizabeth Reeser from the Twilight movies and Young Adult plays a widow with two daughters, and she is kind of a phony medium, and she has these, like, theatrically staged seances in her house, you know, for people to communicate with loved ones.
Right.
And then, you know, older daughter brings a Ouija board into the house and all heck breaks loose. It turns out, like, there's terrible things that happen in that house and beings who are still there.
It's still PG-13, right?
It's still PG-13, but as I said on
Is there a lot of jump scare going on?
Not a lot, actually, no.
Really?
What I said on What the Flick was a lot of times PG-13 movies feel like R-rated horror movies that have been dialed down.
Yes.
And this feels like a PG horror movie that's been kicked up a notch.
Okay, maybe.
I'm not saying necessarily went to this one either, but I'm saying before Jack Reacher, well,
I'm not buying a ticket for this. Okay, might watch it next Halloween.
All right.
On the TV,
it has some. You know, the performance is really good. The little Lulu Wilson, I think is her name, who plays
Lulu Lemon.
No, oh, everyone makes that joke. Lulu Wilson, who plays.
Does everyone make that joke?
Yes.
But, I live in the bubble.
You do. Yeah. Who plays the younger daughter is genuinely creepy and, like, transforms from, like, you know, adorable little girl with the, you know, flip hairdo to, like, blah, you know, pretty well. Henry Thomas plays the priest who's the principal of the school where the girls go.
Right.
Yeah, it's actually pretty cool. And there's neat little period touches to it, like, you know, it's got the opening title card with, like, the, you know, copyright at the bottom of the screen, yes. You know, old school. They put in those little white cigarette burn things in the corner of the screen at the real changes.
The real changes.
Even though it's digital and there are no real changes,
right.
You know. So it's a little bit of a grindhousey kind of, you know, inside joke there. I thought it was actually pretty effectively creepy. And the reviews have been much kinder for this one than for the first one. But I think that the Scott Mendelson on Forbes was sort of comparing it to... he was comparing it to Tomb Raider, which I don't remember the second one being particularly better than the first one. But
there was a second Tomb Raider?
There was, yeah. But
did
I don't remember it being
I
any good.
It?
Probably. But it's the thing where basically you can make a sequel that's better than the first movie, but if there were people who were turned off by the first movie, they're not going to go see it even if the sequel's better.
Right.
You know, Ouija was, I thought, an adequate sort of kiddie horror movie, and this one is actually has more ambitions than that, and I think is more successful than that. So
okay, so I'm just going down our checklist here. We mm-hmm. talked about Boo.
Yes.
We're saving The Handmaiden for next week because
yes.
neither of one of us have seen
Correct.
It
we haven't seen Christine yet either, which we need to watch.
Or Christine, right? You just now glossed over Jack Reacher.
Yeah, there's not much to say, really. I mean, Tom Cruise is still a movie star, and, you know, if he makes this thing go down
then
easy.
Then there's the Ouija.
He and Colby Smulders have pretty good chemistry.
Then there's Keeping Up with the Joneses.
Which
I will not see ever.
No, never.
I will never see
Never
that.
See Keeping Up with the Joneses. It's a gigantic waste of time. It is such a perfunctory, by-the-numbers, like, spies move into the suburbs farce. I laughed, maybe never. I think I might have had a few or something, you know. It's just dull. And I said in my review, all four of those actors and Greg Mottola, who directed it, who did Adventureland and Superbad and the Day Trippers, you know that every day they were like, all right, we're going to go do this thing. Like, I don't think anybody for a second thought this is going to be special or funny or interesting or whatever. I think somebody else put it like they had a copy of their paycheck sitting in the limo every morning to remind them why they were going to work.
There's a really interesting Richard Brody article in the New Yorker The New Yorker.
That's where he writes, My best friend, Richard Brody.
Your best friend, Richard Brody. Yes. It's an article about this movie.
Richard Brody wrote an article about Keeping Up with the Joneses?
Yeah.
What does he have to say about it?
Well, it's partly a review.
Okay.
And I follow him on Twitter.
Yeah, no, he's great.
And his tweet was...
By the way, I was kidding before when I said my best friend. We were on a jury together. We hung out. It was lovely. I have nothing but wonderful thoughts about him. I'm just kidding the idea that we're best friends because, like, we met once.
Where was I?
His article about this movie.
His tweet was that it was apocalyptically bad.
Yes.
But the article he wrote is not a takedown.
Uh-huh.
It's about this kind of filmmaking and how this kind of filmmaking is reliant upon and in the service of creating movie stars, which perpetuates this kind of filmmaking.
Interesting.
And so he talks about how there is one comic actor in the film, Zach Galifianakis.
Right.
There are three more good actors in the film, but none of them are especially known as comic actors.
I would argue Isla Fisher.
John Hamm can do comedy if the material is strong.
Yes.
Isla Fisher means nothing to me. I've never seen her in a film that I thought was good. So
I liked her in Wedding Crashers more than I liked the movie.
Wedding Crashers is whatever.
It is whatever, but she's funny in it.
Okay. And then there's Gal Gadot.
I'm hearing now it's Gadot.
Gadot.
Because she's Israeli and not French, and they pronounce the T, is what I'm being told. Gadot.
Interesting.
Yeah.
Like, why does everyone always tell me it's Gal Gadot?
Because we're used to it's Samuel Beckett's fault, I guess.
I guess. I want to hear it out of her mouth. You let Wonder Woman come to me and tell me how to say her name.
I'm reminded of a moment I had in high school where...
Not that it matters. She'll always be Giselle to me.
Yeah, of course. Yes, I know. I was standing in the library one time, and the head librarian, and who was younger and not ever very nice, and the associate librarian, who was older and very sweet, were looking at some list of something, and the head librarian made some mention of Waiting for Godot. And the associate librarian and I locked eyes and then looked away.
So this film has one comic actor and three other actors.
Yes.
And a bad script.
Yes. From the guy who wrote You, Me, and Dupree.
He goes on to say that he thinks that Mottola is good with actors and is giving them as much opportunity as he can for them to
inject life into the material,
perform the function of a movie star in order for future projects with these people to come around.
Right.
Then he also goes on to say that these kinds of films, and I thought this was really smart and true, these kinds of films are old Hollywood.
Oh, yeah.
Where a semblance of normal life is presented on screen.
Mm-hmm.
But back in the olden times, normal life was part of film. Characters were normal people involved in some kind of circumstance.
Right.
And that was because people went to the movies all the time.
Yeah, movies were the TV of that time. So and you had stuff like the Ma and Pa Kettle movies or the Blondie movies that were basically TV shows.
Yeah. And now, movies... not long ago, I asked my Facebook page, the people, my Facebook friends, how often do you go to the movies?
Mm-hmm.
Statistics are something like...
5 times a year?
3 to 6 times a year for most people. Which is, in my mind...
Insane.
Insane. That's unheard. Like, I'm in a movie 3 to 6 times a week.
Yeah.
And obviously...
It's everyone, our job.
It's my job. Everyone's job is not to do this. But the...
The guy who sells peanuts at Dodger Stadium would be appalled at how few baseball games we go to.
Right. Zero of them. He then goes on to say that because now films are events, we go to films that we consider events. We're not going to see normal life. We're going to see a fantastic experience, something that is fantastical. And now in cinema, normal life has been relegated to the art house.
Yes.
In his words, packaged for elite audiences, which I thought was kind of funny. Are you and I elite audience? Do we count as that? I never think of myself like that, but I guess automatically I am.
Well,
as a film critic,
here's the thing though, we see everything.
True.
We go to the art house and we go see Madea. Yes. Like we would have gone to see Madea even if it weren't our jobs.
That's true.
and I reject the notion that people who I don't know, most people I know who go to art house films also go to all the superhero movies and stuff. They like movies. Right. They're interested in movies and they're all their manifestations.
But how many of our art house movie friends go deep into the lowbrow stuff? How many of them?
Okay, maybe fewer. But I don't know. The word elite, I think, carries this.
That's his word, not mine.
Right, well.
Yeah. That's Richard Brody's word, not mine.
Richard Brody has written a book about Godard. He probably wrote it in French, so I don't want to hear him talking to me about the elite. Oh, yeah.
Sometimes he tweets entirely in French.
Oh, yeah.
And I am like, I don't know. Because he writes for French publications.
Yeah. So his notion of the elite is, you know, I don't know. But no, I mean,
it's a fascinating article. I think he's so cool. He's such a great writer.
In that you get excited about the new Hu Xiaoxian, that automatically makes you like 0.1% of the American movie.
That's what I said to Matt on the way out of Madea. A summer or two summers ago.
Oh, right. You took him to see...
There was a Hu Xiaoxian retrospective at the Hammer, and I took him to see Good Men, Good Women.
Mm-hmm.
Or, no, was it Good Men, Good Women?
Yes.
Or was it?
Yeah, it was.
Yeah. And on the way out of Madea, I said, hey, remember that time I took you to the Hammer to see Hu Xiaoxian's Good Men, Good Women? And he goes, yes. I go, well, what we just did was the opposite of that.
Speaking of the Hammer and directors you love, listener John posted on our page that apparently Apichatpong Virasethakul went to Didi Reese last night.
Oh, did he really?
Yes.
That's funny.
Didi Reese, for people who don't live in Los Angeles, is this amazing ice cream and cookie place that is right by the UCLA campus. And everything there is super cheap. What's their secret? Volume, volume, volume. Whenever you go there, there's a line out the door and down the block, right. And they get you in and out of there really fast, and you get your ice cream and or cookies, and you are out.
Remember the time that we were standing in line for that place?
Yeah, I know the story you're about to tell.
And the sexy sorority girl came up to us and wanted to cut in line.
Oh,
and
a different
was
one.
using that.
She thought that was going to work on us.
Quality in herself. Oh, look, here are these middle-aged guys.
I'm going to go turn on the charm.
I'm going to go turn on the charm and get cut in line.
No cuts.
I was like, end of the line's back there. No cuts. cuts. That's right, no cuts.
I thought you were
number one rule in life. Yes. No cuts.
I thought you were going to tell the story about the time that we were in front of a gaggle of college girls who went to Vanderbilt. They had like Vanderbilt T-shirts or something on, and I said, "Oh, I went there," and I said, "I said I'm class of '88," and you go, "They weren't born yet."
I'd forgotten all about that.
Well, that's the one I remember.
Yeah. So anyway, that article by Richard Brody in The New Yorker, you should go find it.
I'm going to go read it.
Clearly, it's more important for you to do that than to actually see with the Joneses.
And I will say this, and something that occurred to me, and I'm sure Richard goes into this, is that like when people talk about movies as products,
yeah,
they are thinking of movies like Keeping Up with the Joneses, which is it's not based on anything, it's not based on an intellectual property, but it is as perfunctory and just lowest common denominator dragging as any kind of like toy adaptation movie, which weirdly enough, actually Ouija is, a toy adaptation,
a toy movie.
And which I find hilarious because, Hasbro, when they make a Transformers movie, they want you to go home and buy Transformers. The Ouija movies, when people use the Ouija board, awful things happen.
Yeah, but not in real life. In real life, nothing happens.
In real life,
you call me baby.
There are not Transformers either. But the idea is they're trying to sell you the toy. I can't imagine anybody running home from Ouija.
They're robots in disguise.
we'll talk about it later.
Yes, they're real.
And we'll have a discussion about this. Anyway, I can't imagine the idea of a guy going to see Ouija and think, "Oh, I'm going to get me one of them Ouija boards so I can open up the portal of hell."
I guarantee you.
People do.
Sales of Ouija boards go up when this kind of movie opens.
Probably, yes. I mean, just from the exposure.
Because it's fun.
I'm just saying, it's funny that usually in a movie, they don't portray the product as being the thing that's going to open the portal to hell.
We had a Ouija board when I was a kid. And then my oldest brother, Tim,
found God.
Got born again. Mm. Much like Medea getting fake born again in this film. And he made us get rid of it.
What a pill. Allow me to kill all the joy.
My brother. The minute he started going to church, to the Assembly of God church, that was the end of
fun.
Any kind of, naughty fun going on. And here it was. I was just on the cusp of becoming a teenager when it happened. So I was just about to get ready to go see like R-rated movies and stuff. And
nope.
That was, yeah. Now, thank goodness for my my heathen father who just took me to R-rated movies anyway. But,
right.
Yeah, my brother Tim, he was sort of a surrogate parent. I talked about this on LKTV.
Yes.
This past week. And he was... it was his influence that kept me from seeing Rocky Horror Picture Show as a teenager. But yeah, we couldn't have the Ouija board anymore. I wasn't allowed to go see Tommy because of his influence. He said, no. My dad asked him. My dad was, at wit's end. And my brother had just become a Christian and had started filtering the culture, that we were allowed to see or not see. And my dad would listen to him. And so Tim came home from Tommy and said, "No, the kids cannot see Tommy."
See, my brother doesn't even have the excuse of Jesus, but he told my parents that the spy who loved me was too hot for me, which means that my first Bond movie in the theater was Moonraker. Thanks, Fernando.
Funny. So, anyway.
Other movies.
You saw Michael Moore in Trump Land?
Yes, I did.
I'm not going to watch that either.
Yeah, it's not much. It's okay. It's funny that there was an article a few months ago when one of like the Beyonce albums dropped out of nowhere.
Right.
And just appeared one day. Somebody, I think it was in relation to Horace and Pete.
Yeah.
where somebody said, is this going to be a new thing now where like movies and TV shows just appear one day with no advance hype and no notice and just suddenly, bam, here it is, go buy it.
Good, I hope so, yeah. That'd be
and,
nice.
And yeah, and Horace and Pete was an example of that, and that was really great. If you have not gone to Louis C.K.'s website and watched his 8-episode, right, series, Horace and Pete?
6 or 8, something like that.
Go watch Horace and Pete. It's extraordinary.
Yeah, it really is.
Anyway, so Michael Moore suddenly has a movie that nobody knew about. It's called Michael Moore in Trumpland, and it is a concert film, basically. He did stand up at a theater in Wilmington, Ohio, in Clinton County, Ohio, but it's very much Trump country. And he's basically trying to kind of find the common ground with the Trump people and make a case for why to vote for Hillary Clinton. And he comes at it from an interesting place, and he admits up front, he goes, I've never voted for Hillary Clinton in my life. He goes, in the 2008 primaries, I voted for Obama. This year, I was supporting Bernie. Like, I've never voted for Hillary Clinton in my life. And then tries to kind of sort of lay out the things of why she would actually be good at this. And the stand-up part is pretty painful. It's super hacky and bumper stickery. It's the kind of thing where, like, he asks the men in the audience, like, if they're against abortion to raise their hands. And when they do, he says, well, then you shouldn't have one. That kind of thing. Like, that level of just, like, humor. When he sits down and starts talking about Hillary...
Yeah.
And how, like, he, you know, how he sort of had a crush on her during, like, the impeachment hearings and stuff.
I don't want to know about that.
But it's at least, it's amusing, and he does lay out this sort of, like, lifetime of public service that she has behind her. And he, you know, he even says, and you know, you've said other comedians have said this, but he's like, fine, I hope she did kill Vince Foster. You know, let ISIS be worried about a woman who has, according to the internet, murdered 26 people, you know, as opposed to the draft dodger, you know.
26?
Yeah.
Really?
Apparently, according to some websites, yeah.
Whoa.
They implicate her in 26 different murders. Yeah.
That's a lot of killings.
Totally. It's not.
House of cards.
It is mostly not much. There are a few moments I think that are kind of effective. And if you're a big fan of Moore's, you might want to check it out. But Christy and I were talking about this on What the Flick. Like, the Michael Moore movies, when they work best, it's because he is dogging somebody who does not want to be interviewed. You know, and he is like he's kind of relentlessly chasing them down. He's making them have these uncomfortable on camera confrontations. He's raising issues that people don't want to talk about or whatever. Or he's, you know, doing some sort of weird example of a thing that somebody suggested, or like, you know, taking something to its farthest, you know, possibility or whatever. And this is just him talking alone, and him talking alone is not nearly as interesting. But it's, you know, it's an interesting novelty. Obviously, it's not going to matter at all one way or the other after the election.
Right.
So it's got its few weeks in the spotlight, but it is, it's on iTunes already. So, you know, if you're not living in New York or LA or a handful of other movies where it's screening theatrically, you can watch it there. But it's, you know, nothing special.
All right. I did, see Tower finally.
Oh, good. Okay.
Now here's my question.
Yes.
It played in Los Angeles for 1 week.
Yes.
Now it is gone.
Mm-hmm.
Is this film being distributed theatrically in any larger way?
Is it
going straight to streaming very soon?
I don't know. I would imagine... I don't know how distribution works anymore. I don't know. I don't know what happens with secondary markets now, if they exist or if it just everything jumps now to VOD. But if it isn't opening near you soon, it will be available to you soon, I imagine, via streaming. So we should go ahead and talk about it because I think it's one of the best documentaries of the year.
It is pretty extraordinary. It's about the UT sniper.
Yes.
Which maybe you don't know about that. August 1st, 1966.
Mm-hmm. 50 years ago.
A man named Charles Whitman got some guns, and he got up in the bell tower at University of Texas in Austin, and he opened fire, and he shot nearly 50 people. 15 or 16 of them died.
Yes.
He was killed in the ensuing, you know, standoff with police. And before he got up to the tower, he had already killed some...
His wife and his mother.
His wife and his mother, and also some employees at UT on his way up into the tower.
Mm.
This is a documentary.
It is.
Do we call it a documentary, or do we call it,
is,
it a?
It is a documentary, but in
piece of journalism.
It's a documentary, but it uses stylistic touches that you will recognize from The Thin Blue Line or from Waltz with Bashir, where a thing has happened that there's only a certain amount of actual footage for it. And so what the filmmaker has done is he has actors portraying the people involved so that they'll be, in some cases, alive or in other cases, the right age for 1966.
Yes.
But then he rotoscopes the footage of those people. They trace them and animate them. And so...
Which is a wonderful idea, because when a reenactment happens in a documentary, it immediately...
looks fake.
Turns it into something crappy.
Yeah, it's like, you know, Emergency 911 or those old cheesy shows. So because it's animated, like, there's a consistency to it. Like, he doesn't have to worry about making... the University of Texas look exactly like it did in 1966. He's able to overlay it and do that for it. And by having actors telling you the story, you know,
in a first person way,
it becomes,
this was my day. This happened.
It becomes like a direct testimony. And then at some point in the film, he starts introducing in the real people as they are now, as they are still alive, in a way that is very effective and very powerful. It's a really solid reveal, and it takes the movie into whole other areas that it hadn't already gone to.
It is stylistically very cool. It is emotionally powerful.
Yes.
And it is a story about a thing that happened 50 years ago that might as well have happened yesterday.
Right. This was America's first mass shooting on a college campus. I think mass shooting, period, right?
I don't know.
But definitely mass school shooting.
And so everything that it brings up about contemporary life is still... it's really relevant.
Yeah. And they never have to lay it on with a trowel because it's just there.
Yeah. I love this in a way that, you know, you don't recommend a film like this and say it sure is entertaining.
No.
It's just really powerful and moving and meaningful. If you will sit down with it for the 80 minutes.
Yeah.
It's pretty short. You will have.
There are rewards.
Used your time wisely.
Yeah,
it's really, really great.
Yeah,
I don't know how you're supposed to see it though, if it's not playing anywhere. have to really hunt.
It's not playing in Los Angeles. It may well be in other cities.
Look for it. It's from a filmmaker whose name is Keith Maitland.
Yes,
Maitland. And
it won, I think, like 3 major Doc Awards at South by Southwest this year. Yeah. So, it's a really, it's a gut punch movie. And it's, you forget that you're not just, the animation stuff, the things that seem they might be distracting are not. And you just, it becomes part of how the story's being told. And you get totally absorbed into how the day unfolds.
I also saw the new Kelly Reichardt film.
Oh, good.
Certain Women.
Which I saw at Sundance, so my memories are going to be a little fuzzier than yours.
I will tell you the plot. This is based on...
Short stories.
Some short stories by a writer named Maile Malloy, I think that is her name. I have not read the stories. I have not read anything by this author. But I might now.
Hmm.
The film is about... 3 main women, Laura Dern, Michelle Williams, and Kristen Stewart.
I would say Lily Gladstone.
Yes, but I think the film takes those three as its main
launching points.
Points, yeah. They don't know each other, these women. Laura Dern is a lawyer. In Livingston, I think, Montana. I think that's the name of the town. There's talk of Billings. I know that. And there's talk of other even smaller towns in Montana. It's all set in Montana. She's a lawyer, and she is helping Jared Harris with a workers' comp lawsuit that is going very badly.
Yeah.
And there are unintended consequences of his depressed mental state as a result of this lawsuit that is not going his way and will not ever go his way. The second story is Michelle Williams married to James LeGros. And she wants to get some rock from a man they kind of know.
Rene Auberginois.
Yeah, from Benson.
I think of him from McCabe and Mrs. Miller, but sure. He was also on one of the Star Treks. He gets around, that Rene Auberginois.
She wants to build her house. And guys are not exactly helping her in the way that she would like them to help her. This echoes Laura Dern's situation as a lawyer whose involvement with guys is always a pain.
There's a great scene where she's been telling Jared Harris the same thing over and over again.
Oh, yeah.
And it's,
that's what I was getting at. And I kind of want you to save it.
Okay.
It's a really significant moment in her story.
Okay. I won't give it away.
And then the third story is Kristen Stewart, a young lawyer just out of college, just out of law school, finding employment difficult to come by. So she volunteers for a really crappy job where she has to drive 4 hours to get to an educational law class that she knows nothing about and has to do tons of research for to teach these six adults.
These teachers, and who all they want to talk about is parking spaces.
None of whom could be bothered to care about the actual topic. Their concerns are very immediate and very much in the realm of, why can't they do this for me? I'm a teacher. Their questions for her are always about the parking spaces. How soon can they kick a badly behaving student out of their class? And nothing that she's lecturing them about has anything to do with the rubber hitting the road of public school teaching.
Right.
But there is a young woman in the class who is not a teacher. She's a ranch hand. And she comes into the class just because she's curious about the class. And then she sees Kristen Stewart. And she becomes silently and perfectly in the deepest unrequited love with Kristen Stewart. There are tendrils of connection between these three stories.
Right.
Paths do cross. But what you really have here is a simultaneous moment in the life of three women who are, in the lives of three women who are essentially strangers to each other, who wouldn't even maybe know what connects them.
Mm-hmm.
And in at least one case, you don't want to know what connects them.
Right.
But it's about this passing moment in complex lives. There was story before the movie started. There's going to be story after the movie's over. And you get to watch
this slice.
A slice of it. And it's about how, if it's about any one thing, it's about how weird it is as a woman to go about a daily life when people around you either aren't paying attention to you or aren't listening to you or aren't helping you in any way.
Right.
The kicker for me of the film, aside from the fact that Kelly Reichardt is the kind of filmmaker that lets me breathe and lets me think and lets me daydream and moves slowly and quietly. You're never going to hear a sudden car crash noise. You are working deliberately with her as she makes the story. You are deliberately working with her as a spectator, as an involved watcher of the story. But what kicked me in the gut in this movie and left me, I will confess to this, in tears.
Hmm.
A young actress named Lily Gladstone.
Oh my God, she's so good in this.
As the ranch hand.
Yeah.
And she will make your heart break.
Yes.
And it will stay broken and you will feel sad. You will feel sadness as you walk to your car. It will end when you drive through Chick-fil-A. But that is not the movie's fault.
Yeah, Lily Gladstone is extraordinary. I was just talking to Tim, our friend Tim Grierson, who was on the Gotham Awards.
If you people at LA Film Critics don't give her Best Supporting Actress for this movie, I will never forgive any of you.
I make no promises, but she's certainly got my vote. She
barely speaks.
I know.
In the film,
the Gotham Awards gave her nominated her for best breakthrough performance.
Everything she does is so detailed and so precise and yes. So moving and so, so very much like a human being.
It's so human, yeah.
So very much like a human being that it's as though you don't watch human beings in films anymore. And getting back to Richard Brody's essay, you kind of aren't. This is playing in Los Angeles. I'm sure it's slowly rolling out around the country.
It's in New York.
If you've never seen a Kelly Reichardt film, be prepared for a lot of quiet, a lot of silence, and a lot of not much stuff happening.
Right. Yes, definitely. It's funny that you mentioned this.
Please go see it. It's so good.
I just listened to the Bret Easton Ellis podcast interview with Paul Schrader.
Yeah.
And Schrader is actually working on an updated edition of Transcendental Style in Film, which is one of the books that is currently holding up your microphone. But he made a joke about how they're making slow movies so fast I can barely keep up with them.
Right.
I'm sure he'll talk about Reichardt quite a bit.
Well, he might. Yeah. He might not. I don't know.
Yeah. But it's, Certain Women is gorgeous and moving and all the things.
So is Moonlight.
So is Moonlight.
Which opens this week.
Yes. Moonlight.
You talk about Moonlight.
Oh, man. Okay. So this is Barry Jenkins' second film. His debut was 10 years ago. And working with a playwright named Terrell McCraney, who did kind of an autobiographical piece about a young black gay kid, coming of age. And the movie is divided into three segments. There's kind of a childhood, high school, and young adulthood. And we follow this character named Chiron, who at the beginning we see him running from kids in his class who are bullying him, and he's hiding out in what would become a crack den, basically. And the local drug dealer, played by Marshall Ali, kind of, helps him out, takes him to get something to eat. We find out that Chiron has a single mother, played by Naomi Harris, who at the beginning of the film seems to sort of have it together, like she works as a nurse or something. But soon it's clear that she is doing drugs and buying them from Marshall Ali, even though he scolds her for not being a better mother. And so Marshall Ali and his girlfriend, who's played by Janelle Monáe, kind of become these sort of surrogate parents to Chiron, but he's in a bad place and in a bad home life. And it's that thing where the rest of the world knows he's gay and he doesn't quite process it yet.
Because you're a little kid.
Yeah, you're a little kid. You don't know anything. It doesn't mean anything to you, but other kids and certainly other adults can just smell it on you.
Right.
You know.
Right.
Then you get to high school and,
listen, in fourth grade, in gym class, when I couldn't catch the ball, Dickie Holt, wherever you are, I remember you. He called me that F word. Mm. And here's how sheltered I was. I didn't know what that word meant. Mm. I just thought it meant you couldn't catch a ball. I didn't know I was supposed to be ashamed.
Right.
Later, I learned what that word meant. Because my dad used it. And not at me. My dad didn't call me that name. But then I was like, oh, why did he call me that? Later, of course.
Right.
You realize people see you, even when you don't see yourself.
Yeah.
So continue.
So then he gets to high school and, you know, teenagers have more ways of calling you the F word than the Inuits reportedly have words for snow.
Yes.
And he is tormented by some kids, and there exists the possibility of genuine connection, but then that it very quickly turns into something else. And then we see him as an adult, and he is physically transformed, but he is still the same kind of broken person inside, and there exists a possibility of reconnection. And I am loath to trot out the word poetic.
But it is.
Because that is such a turnoff for me when I hear from other people. But no, yeah, this movie is genuinely poetic. It is beautiful to look at. It is so compassionate towards its characters and empathetic without telling you who they are.
Yeah.
It lets them show you who they are. The movie never tells you what it's about, but it lets you figure it out and follow along with it and care. And it is just so gorgeous and painful and perfect, this movie. Mm-hmm. I really love it.
It is all of those things. As filmmaking, I think it's gloriously beautiful and subtle. There are cliche elements, stereotypical elements in the film. I give it that easily. And there's
one musical choice where I was like, oh, really? We're going to do this? Mm-hmm. Okay.
So, but again, everything else is so impeccable and precise that it's swatting away flies.
Yes.
It's not a thing. What moved me so much about this is that it gets right what dozens and dozens and hundreds of LGBT filmmaking examples get wrong. Now, you work for Outfest, and I've seen some of the most god-awful filmmaking in the name of telling queer stories that I, to use the word loath, just like you did, I am often loath to go to see a queer film.
Barry Jenkins is straight, by the way.
I know, but he's a good filmmaker, and that means he made a good film.
Yes.
About queer people.
Yes, the writer is gay.
And I have seen the growing up gay story more times than I can count. I have seen the coming out story more times than I can count. I have seen it from the young white male perspective. I have seen it from the young white female perspective. I have seen it from the black perspective, from the Latino perspective, from the Asian perspective, from the South African middle-aged angry suburban dad perspective, from the French teenager perspective, from the young working class British kids perspective.
I've seen five times the number of these movies.
And I know. Exactly. I've seen it.
But you've never seen it like this.
And this is so great. This is the one of the... How many other great gay films have there been this year? Being 17 is a very good teenage gay film.
I liked Other People a lot, but this is a whole other level.
Other People is fine. Other People is very good. It's not as good as being 17.
Mm-hmm.
This is really great. It is the exception that proves the rule.
Yeah.
I've already heard a couple queer media people say, I've seen this before. And I think to myself, have you recently seen this kind of thing? Have you seen something this good before? I mean, yes, you've seen this story.
In a way,
but have you seen this kind of good film about this story before, recently?
Even calling it a coming out story feels reductive.
I know. And I'm using that.
It is a coming of age story, definitely.
To talk about it, yeah.
Yeah, no, it is unto itself, because you just don't see movies, gay or straight or black or white or whatever, movie. You don't see movies with this level of craft, and beauty and emotional sensitivity.
Yeah. So do that.
Yeah, seek this one out. It will be coming to you if it's not near you already. A24 has it, so it will. And it's you're going to be hearing about it during award season, at least on the end of like Critics Awards and Spirit Awards.
Yeah.
Oscars, who knows? But, it'll be around.
Have I recommended Old Joy as a DVD before?
I have no idea.
How about Wendy and Lucy?
I don't know. Just pick, Wendy and Lucy. Why not? Go for it.
Wendy and Lucy.
Okay.
Speaking of Michelle Williams, speaking of Kelly Reichardt.
That's probably
Michelle Williams is her go-to person, by the way. She's been in three of her five films, yeah.
And Wendy and Lucy is probably my favorite of the Reichardt movies so far.
Wendy and Lucy's the toughest.
That too.
Wendy and Lucy's the most heart-wrenching.
Yep. Yes, it is, and it is my favorite.
Sure. One. In fact, this Certain Women is dedicated to Lucy.
Mine is
Lucy alive anymore?
That was dedicated to her, maybe not. I don't know. I don't want to think about it. My DVD pick this week is Medicine for Melancholy, which is Barry Jenkins' previous film, which has the same cinematographer, and both films are gorgeous, but they're gorgeous in completely different ways.
Wendy and Lucy stars Michelle Williams as a young woman who is poor, and she is sort of on the road with her dog. And it gets bad.
Yeah. Medicine for Melancholy stars Wyatt Cenac from The Daily Show.
Yeah.
And it is it's my favorite kind of rom-com. It's a walking and talking one day getting to know you movie.
I got a letter.
Got
three letters.
Okay.
But first, why don't you join our club?
Yeah. Do it.
If you join our club, you get things.
Mm-hmm.
You get more podcasts.
Yes.
You get LKTV, which is a podcast of the television.
Mm-hmm. This week, we talked a lot about the Fox Rocky Horror Picture Show remake.
Yeah, we sure did.
We had some opinions.
You get that. You get, and depending on what level of club member you become, you get even more things than just a podcast. You get more podcasts. You get objects. You get
shirts and bags and mugs.
You get personal time.
It's true.
With your favorite podcast.
Google Hangouts.
We Google Hangout with you while we all watch a movie together. We're fixing a Google Hangout with people who all read a book together.
Yes.
Yeah. So do that. It's $4 a month if you want to get in on the ground level, which is my favorite level, because I'm down cheap. There. I'm down there. At
any level, we love it when you do it.
Yeah.
Patreon.com/linoleumknife, all one word. And since we are getting into the Christmas season, this is a good time.
No,
don't know what I'm going to say.
Do I?
You don't.
Don't I?
You don't.
Won't you?
Since we're getting into the Christmas shopping season, if you ever go to our Facebook page, you will notice that every week I link to yours and my DVD picks of the week.
Yes.
And I do it with an Amazon code that links it to where we get a kickback on your purchases.
Is that where that comes from?
Yeah. So when you go to...
I thought it was because you took a lot of Gallup polls and they pay you like 50 cents
for that. That's a different thing. I get those too. But I also get it because our listeners click on those links. And here's the thing. You don't...
Okay, here's what happens.
Dave, shut up, please, and let me finish. Okay. Thank you very much.
Okay.
If you click on the link, You don't have to buy that DVD. I mean, if you do, great, because we recommended it. But you don't, as long as that's your entry into Amazon, go to that page with the thing, then move away from that DVD. Go shopping for whatever else you were going to buy, you know, fishing poles or sweaters or shoes or books or whatever. If that code is the one that got you in,
nunchucks,
we get a kickback on whatever you purchase. And it helps us a lot. It helps us buy our fiber.
I was about to say, is that who buys our Metamucil?
Yeah, our listeners.
You guys buy our Metamucil.
Yes. Bless their hearts. We need that stuff. So yeah, if you go buy the DVDs that we recommend, terrific.
Every so often you come in with a check. It's not a check, but it's a credit. Amazon credit, you're like, go buy us some Metamucil with this credit.
So go click on our links, buy your stuff. Whether or not it's the thing you link to in the first place, and we get a kick.
I might have used to know this and then forgot.
Probably.
All right.
It is quite likely.
Okay, a letter. This is from Mint, M-Y-N-T, Mint, in Canada. Hey, Dave and
Alonzo. Cool Mint.
Hey, Dave and Alonzo. Shut up. Hey, Dave and Alonzo. Listening to your commentary on the BBC Best of the Century so far sparked a question in my mind for you two. I generally side with Dave on film. That's smart of you.
Whatever.
With a healthy mix of art house and outrageously bonkers pop filmmaking, and right now I am making my way through the Tsai Ming Lang filmography. I was lucky.
How elite of you.
Yeah. I was lucky to be introduced to Vive l'Amour in a university class and got to write about Goodbye Dragon Inn for a different course a couple of years later. Comparing it to Agnès Varda's Cleo from 5 to 7. This interest was, of course, spurred on by Dave's adoration for the director.
Well, all right.
That makes me very happy.
Well, all right.
See, it's not all just chit-chat and claptrap.
We're changing lives.
However, I cannot help but be concerned that the only films from outside the English-speaking world I hear about are the ones that English-speaking critics rave about. I can't recall which Italian filmmaker Alonso talked about a few months ago, the one who is very popular with American critics, but is reviled in Italy.
Oh, Luca Guadagnino, who is now remaking Suspiria, apparently.
Yeah, but the BBC list makes me think of that situation. As much as it would be great to see more diversity in the picks of the 177 critics who submitted to the list, I'm significantly more concerned that most of the people polled were primarily from the US and the UK.
No, that's a fair cop.
No, that is a true thing.
Yeah.
At the end of 2015, there was a small but vocal number of critics who came out of the woodwork to support Magic Mike XXL. I count myself among them. And the more worrying thought I had when reading the BBC list is that nowhere in my media am I getting the films from Asia, Africa, and Latin America that were not art house festival darlings. Where is the Taiwanese Moulin Rouge or the Indian Finding Nemo? They're in Taiwan and India.
Yeah. I mean, look, I it's hard to say because there is a hierarchy of it goes beyond critics because it's also about distributors.
This is primarily a distribution situation. Yeah,
you know, to some extent, film festivals. You know, but yeah, that's who kind of decides what everybody sees.
You go to other countries and they've got their own filmmaking apparatus.
Yeah.
There and their mainstream cinema never makes it to North America. It just doesn't. What comes to North America from other countries is art house, and the reason that comes to us is because of film festivals and film critics.
Right.
So we're not going to get the cop movie from Pakistan.
Right.
We're going to get the one from Indonesia. It's called The Raid!
So
I am limited in what I can see.
I mean, do we want to see the Liechtensteinian Paul Blart?
What if it's really great?
I like to think that if something is special and stands out, hits the festival circuit or something.
Not necessarily.
Not necessarily, but I think in a lot of cases it does.
But I don't know. Who programs the film festivals? Art house minded people.
Right, because who attends film festivals?
Film critics and art house people. So is that genre genre film going to make it here? It's not going to make it here, no matter how good it is.
I don't know. I mean, it depends on the genre. I mean, if it's a splatter horror movie, its chances are very good.
Okay, yes, yes.
Because, you know, you've got Sundance in Toronto. A lot of people have these midnight sections. You've got Fantastic Fest now.
Yes, yes.
That all they do is...
Whoa.
All they do...
Come on.
Sorry. we've only been doing this show for 6 years. I can't be expected to understand how the tech works. Where all the films are, genre films. I don't know. I think really, I don't even know where I'm going with this. But yes, you're right. Absolutely, there is a limited pipeline of what we see and who sees it and who decides what the best is. And I don't know what the answer to that is, but it's a question that deserves to be raised.
I agree. From Kevin. He says, every year my hometown holds a film festival where they show a selection of indie movies that wouldn't normally be seen in a small-town Minnesota setting.
Hmm.
I think that's great.
Yeah.
It's always an event I look forward to, and I was wondering what you guys think of this year's recently announced lineup.
Okay.
The Hunt for the Wilder People.
I've not seen it, but I heard nothing but great things.
We just got the DVD,
yes.
And it's sitting on our...
Mount Unwatched.
Gotta watch stack. Cafe Society.
Mm. Eh.
Woody Allen, fine.
Yeah, not one of the better ones.
Your film festival is going to like it.
Yeah.
Probably. Captain Fantastic.
I liked it quite a bit.
I disliked it quite a bit. I think Viggo Mortensen's performance is pretty great, and I think the movie is full of itself.
I disagree.
Yeah. Don't Think Twice. I did not see
it. Did not see it.
It's the improv comedy.
The Mike Birbiglia movie, yeah. I imagine that'll be in the year-end screening pile.
Right. No, it will be. The new Michel Gondry, Microbe and Gasoline, which came and went without
very fast.
A trace. Like, it was here a week, and then it was gone,
yeah.
And I missed it.
I assigned a review. The guy liked it, but, yeah.
And The Music of Strangers, which is the Yo-Yo Ma documentary.
Yes, which Morgan Neville, who I met at Outfest a couple years ago, because he did... What's the Gore Vidal Buckley documentary, The Debate? Best of Enemies, yes. Yeah. But I have not seen it.
Plus, he says, two special movies... A Minnesotan movie called The Seventh Fire, which I don't know anything about. And a free family film, Kubo and the Two Strings, which is glorious.
It's gorgeous.
Yeah.
The visuals are great. The script is so-so.
Not true. It's fantastic. The whole thing.
You're wrong.
Here's from Keith. Hi, Ricky and Mistook.
Oh.
Oh. This is perhaps my fourth or fifth letter to you wonderful gents. I look forward to hearing you read one in 2024 when you catch up. Wait, did we not read your other letters? Are they sitting in a stack somewhere in the pile of not read?
If he doesn't say, I don't know.
Okay, well, we'll hunt for them.
I thought we were
doing a pretty good job of catching up.
Yeah, I mean, we're up to August.
I was just listening to your recent appearance on the B-Movies podcast.
Oh, that was the best of the decade so far.
Oh, yeah, yeah, yeah. When I heard Alonzo utter what may be his single most entertaining sentence, no one seemed to laugh, however, when he said, I want to like the act of killing more than I do.
It's funny if you take the italics off of this.
But I laughed and I want t-shirts, that is all. Cheers, Keith. Hey,
thank you, Keith.
Hey, everybody.
Speaking of shirts,
why don't you give us all your money? And I'm not talking about subscribing to the Patreon and joining the club,
which you should also do
at patreon.com/linoleumknife. I'm talking about special items that you can now buy. Guess what?
Back by popular demand,
the original Linoleum Knife t-shirt. It is a black cotton t-shirt. And the words Linoleum Knife are written across your beautiful chest. We have them in ladies' sizes. We have them in men's sizes. These sizes go up to 4X. I'm not saying we got a lot of any of these sizes, and we certainly don't have a lot of 4Xs. But if you act fast,
Yes.
You can have one.
First come, first serve.
They're $22. $22.
More if you are outside of the United States. Let us know if you're not
outside of the United States. Let us know if you're outside of the United States.
We'll figure out how much.
Yeah, it costs a lot to ship overseas. But yeah, so $22, you can get a linoleum knife t-shirt. They're fun to enjoy. Also, Alonzo Duralde has written a book about Christmas movies. Perhaps you've heard of it. It's called Have Yourself a Movie Little Christmas.
Yep.
It came out in 2010. It's still in print.
Mm-hmm.
That's a Christmas miracle. You can buy it online pretty cheaply if you're a budget-minded person. However, maybe you're not a budget-minded person. Maybe you're an extravagance-minded person.
Or you want a neat gift.
And you want the special edition, which we have now. This is like the third year we've done the special edition.
I think so, yeah.
The special edition is this. It is a copy of Have Yourself a Movie Little Christmas. That copy has Alonzo Duralde's signature written beautifully in the front. He will autograph it to you or to a person you want to give it to as a gift. Inside the book is treats. Not edible treats, but...
things that will fit into a book.
Things that will fit into a book. Those treats... those treats change from year to year. A couple of them remain the same. But in general, they change. And they're nice, these treats. Some of them involve you getting extra content that you might only get if you were, say, a member of our Patreon club. Some of them are things that you get if you're not a member of the Patreon club.
That are exclusive to book buyers.
Exclusive to the book.
Yes.
Finally, we gift wrap it in Christmas wrapping paper for you. So that when you give it to yourself or a friend or a loved one as a gift, you don't even have to do any work. You just have to pay money.
Hand it off.
$20. $20. That's the $17 retail price of the book plus $3 shipping in the United States. And that's at linoleumpodcast@gmail.com.
PayPal us.
PayPal.
Make sure you include your t-shirt size, the address that we're sending it to, who the book it should be made out to,
right.
All of that good stuff.
All that.
So we don't have to chase you down to ask you. But yeah, we have not had the shirts available for the last year or so because we've had exclusive Patreon shirts. But
so many other shirts to pay,
people
pay
have
for
asked.
And ship out.
So we got a bunch, but when that bunch goes, we won't have them again for a while. So if you've been hankering for one, grab it now.
That's it. We're done.
All right. Awesome. Well, as always, we thank you for listening. And thank you to Blue for our great theme music. You can find out more about all of his great stuff and his performances and albums and whatever he's got coming up at bluetopia.com, BLEUTOPIA. Go check out our friends on the internet. Go to ChristyLemire.com. Listen to the Rotten Tomatoes podcast with Matt and with Matt, who shaved his beard off, and Gray, who just got married.
We're going to her wedding reception tonight.
It's true. The B Movies podcast with Bibbs and Whitney, Dennis Anyone with Dennis Hensley, The Schmoes Know, The Sewers of Paris, The Comics Canon, and The Joel Ryan Thing, The Criterion Cast, Fat Guys of the Movies, Film Spotting SVU, The Game Night Guys, and Secretly Timid. You can subscribe to this show for free on iTunes. And if you want to leave us a review there, please do. It really does help people find the show.
Five stars only.
And if you're already a subscriber and haven't gotten around to reviewing us yet, please do. Even if it's just the stars, that'd be great. But if you want to write a little something too, that'd be awesome. You can also leave us positive feedback in all the places we stream, which includes Stitcher Radio, TheLounge.com, Podbean, and Satchel. You can follow us on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram at LinoleumCast. And again, our email address is linoleumpodcast@gmail.com. That's what you'll use for PayPal if you're buying a shirt or a book. Or if you just want to contact us with questions or comments or top 10 lists or whatever. And join our club at patreon.com/linoleumknife. We'll be back next week where there's really only one big movie opening.
So 10 this week and yes, one next week.
What's I know. Next week? Next week is Inferno. I think between Ron Howard and Halloween, nobody wanted to compete. So.
Inferno.
Yeah, so we'll have that to talk about, but some other stuff as well, of course, and we'll be catching up, and who knows, maybe we'll finally get caught up on letters or something, who knows. All right, thanks for listening, we'll catch you next time.
Goodbye.